From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last week, the FBI arrested a 19-year-old man at Chicago's O'Hare Airport who was allegedly attempting to go to Syria and join ISIS, or the self-declared Islamic State. He is one of a small but growing group of Americans, mostly young Muslim men. Some have been killed on the battlefield. Others, like Mohammed Khan in Chicago, have been arrested before they got there. This hour on Point, Americans and ISIS. You can join us on air or online. Why would young men in America join ISIS? What should be the government's response? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first this hour from New York is Dina Temple-Raston, counterterrorism correspondent for NPR. She's the author of The Jihad Next Door, The Lanawana Six, and Rough Justice in the Age of Terror. Dina Temple-Raston, welcome back to On Point.
It's glad to be here. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Well, bring us up to date on the investigation of this 19-year-old American who was arrested at O'Hare in Chicago, Dina.
Well, he reportedly explained his reasons for attempting to go to join ISIS, or the group that calls itself the Islamic State, in a 3-page letter that he left for his family in his bedroom. And he basically invited them to join him at the Islamic State. He said that Western societies were corrupt, and he didn't want to raise a family in this kind of society. So he was going to join ISIS, not so much to fight, but to be part of this Islamic caliphate or state that they're setting up.
And so how did law enforcement track him down ultimately?
It's a little unclear how they knew exactly to zero in on him. He was in his baggage. There was some material that was ISIS-related. It's unclear if they got a tip from someone who knew him, someone from a local mosque who said he had planned to travel. He shared a bedroom with his younger brother. And they have delayed the hearing in his case until October 21st. And the reason, they said, was because they wanted to protect a minor. And it's unclear whether they were trying to protect the brother in some way.
So help us understand how a 19-year-old American who was raised in this country became radicalized in this case.
Well, it's unclear that he wanted to go specifically to fight. I know that that ISIS gives the impression that all it does is fight, but it also has a sort of another whole level at which it's from which it's trying to appeal to young Muslim men, and that is, we're setting up a society that is the kind of society that if you're a good Muslim, you're supposed to want to be part of. You know, a society in which the women are covered, a society in which Sharia law actually reigns, that sort of thing. And he told the FBI, he waived his Miranda rights, and he allegedly told the FBI that he wanted to go and be on like a police force for the caliphate. So he wasn't sort of, this is different than Al-Qaeda. This is not going to try and necessarily be a terrorist or attack the West. This is different altogether because of this layer of respectability that the Islamic State is trying to set up, saying we are actually a country that abides by Muslim law.
So an interesting piece of this, Dina, is the role that the internet played in this 19-year-old's choices. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, apparently he met someone on the internet who said that if he were to fly to Istanbul, then this particular person would get him to the right person he needed to go to join ISIS or the so-called Islamic State. And, you know, there's an incredible array of various videos that are showing up on the internet that are very slick and very professionally done that are meant to recruit these kinds of people. And I know it's quite striking for it to be in the United States. There are about a dozen young men from the U.S. who have gone and actually joined ISIS. There are about 10 that have been stopped from going in that direction. But if you look at the U.K., there are hundreds of people who have gone to Syria, and some unknown portion of that have actually joined ISIS. So the problem here in the United States, or at least the way these internet videos are resounding or resonating with U.S. citizens, is clearly much less than it is in Europe.
So last week, CNN spoke to a neighbor of this 19-year-old, Mohammed Hamza Khan, who was allegedly trying to go to Syria. Here it is.
Surprised. Really surprised. I mean, the kid was polite, you know. I didn't expect anything like that in the least bit.
So you talked, Dina, about a little bit more broadly how many Americans are suspected of joining ISIS, going over to the Middle East. That number has doubled since January. Is that correct?
Well, I think that they're getting better at counting. So I wouldn't necessarily say that there's been this huge ramp up. I think there's a concern about that. But the number that has doubled since January is the number of people who have actually gone to Syria as opposed to joining ISIS. Mm. So they're somewhere in the neighborhood of 140 to 150 Americans who have gone to Syria. But this is what makes this fight really different than other things we've seen in counterterrorism, is that you could be going to Syria legitimately for humanitarian reasons. I mean, the U.S. government itself does not believe that Assad should be the governing power in Syria. And Assad is gassing his people. He's doing various terrible things to Muslims in his country. So even if you were sort of a not terribly radicalized Muslim, you could see that what's going on there requires you as a good Muslim man to go, or woman, to go and help your brothers in Syria. And the problem is that the battlefield in Syria is so porous. You might be fighting for, say, a rebel group that the U.S. says it will support in the near future. But right next to you can be a group called al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda's arm there in Syria. Or it could be ISIS right next to you, because they're all fighting Assad on some level. And that makes it very, very difficult to figure out what people are doing once they get to Syria.
Let me bring another voice in here, Dina. Joining me now from Chicago is Mohammed Kaiseruddin, chairman of the Council of Islamic Organizations of Greater Chicago. He's also the vice chairman of the Downtown Islamic Center and has worked in the Chicago Muslim community for over 40 years. Mohammed, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jan. Pleased to be here.
Well, thank you. Tell us how the community there has responded to this arrest in Chicago.
Well, the arrest of Mohammed Hamza Khan has shocked the community over here. The young man has been a member of the community, and a lot of people knew him and friends and so on. And all of a sudden, the news that he has been arrested and charged with such a serious crime has shocked the community.
And within the Islamic community specifically, how have they reacted?
The Islamic community, I mean.
Yes.
I mean, I'm talking
I
about
see.
This.
I see.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So what happens when someone goes down this path in your experience, Mr. Kaiseruddin? What are the signs that you look for? And in this case, were those present?
Well, we do not know. I mean, so far, Mohammed Hamza Khan is the third individual from Chicago area who has been captured. None of those people have gone to trial yet. So the stories have not come out as to what were they planning to do and why they were planning to do. As far as Hamza Khan is concerned, Dina just pointed out that one of his motivations was that he thought that the society here was corrupt and he did not want to raise his family in this society. You think, he's a 19-year-old kid and probably a few more years before he will get married and have children, but he was thinking in those terms. But the other thing that FBI has also released is that he was bothered quite a bit about killing of Muslims overseas, atrocities being committed in Iraq and in Syria and in Gaza. And that also he gave as, you know, for example, it seems he said that he did not want his tax dollars to be used to kill Muslims. So that was one of the major motivations also for him to take any actions that he is alleged to have taken.
Dina Temple-Raston, you've reported on this broadly over the years. Is there a common motivation for these young Americans to join the movement?
Yes, I've been reporting on this sort of thing since the Lackawanna Six, which was the group of six young men from upstate New York who, before 9/11, had actually gone to an al-Qaeda camp to train. And one of the things that they have in common is this sort of uncomfortableness, and I don't want to generalize, but an uncomfortableness in their own skin. These are young men who are trying to see how they fit in society, how they demonstrate that they are a good and devout Muslim. And for some people, that might be volunteering at the mosque or helping young men at the mosque or, you know, helping in society. For others, they think that the way that they should be stepping up is to do more. And in the case of ISIS, and I don't want to say that they have actually set up a caliphate that is working, because it's very unclear that it has. And I don't want to say that they have actually set up a country, because they haven't. But what they have provided in its internet sort of propaganda is the idea that they are setting up some sort of Muslim nirvana, that you should be going to. They're even recruiting women to come there and marry ISIS fighters. There are four women in the UK that we know of who have done that, or at least gone to that area with that intention in mind. So it's a little bit different than what we have been seeing in terms of people who are recruited for al-Qaeda. While we see the brutality of ISIS, ISIS is trying to portray itself as more than just this marauding group that is going across Iraq and Syria.
And so, Dina, would it be fair to say that more Americans are making it to the Middle East than are being stopped before they get there?
It's unclear. I think that the FBI feels that it has a pretty good handle on the people that are going. The problem is that if you don't have an ISIS connection, it's not illegal for you to go to Syria or Turkey, which is where most of the people fly to. In Khan's case, he had bought a ticket that was to Vienna and then on to Turkey. What's interesting about this case, and we don't know who paid for that ticket. That was a $4,000 ticket, and he didn't have that kind of money. And this is one of the things I think will come out as the case unfolds.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about Americans joining the self-declared Islamic State, or ISIS. In September, ISIS released a 55-minute-long propaganda film, Flames of War, it was called, on YouTube. The FBI is calling for the public's help to identify an Islamist militant with a North American accent who is featured in the film. In the video, the masked man warns that the fighting has just begun.
We're here with the soldiers of Bashar. You can see them now digging their own graves in the very place where they were stationed. The very place where they were stationed terrorizing the Muslims in Raqqa. Alhamdulillah, the hukm of Allah is going to be carried out on these same soldiers by the brothers from the Muhajirin and Ansar that captured them.
Joining us this hour, Mohammed Kaiser Adin, chairman of the Council of Islamic Organizations of Greater Chicago, and Dina Temple Raston, counterterrorism correspondent for National Public Radio. I'd like to bring in another voice now, Thomas Makaitis, coming to us from Portland, Maine, terrorism expert from DePaul University in Chicago, editor at the journal Small Wars and Insurgencies, author of several books, including Iraq and the Challenge of Counterinsurgency and The New Terrorism. Thomas Makaitis, thank you for being with us.
Hello, Jane. Happy to be here.
Well, thank you. From a law enforcement perspective, how do you effectively identify some of these Americans who are prone to heading overseas, to radicalization, if you will?
Well, I think your guests, particularly the head of the Muslim Center, has indicated that you really need grassroots avenues into the community. Your best sources of intelligence, that's really what you're talking about, are teachers, guidance counselors, imams, and possibly even family members who, in fact, can help to identify these people and basically stop them beforehand. But I also think there's a really big missing piece here. We're approaching this as a problem of law enforcement and not as a problem of rehabilitation. And if we did that, I think you'd get a lot more cooperation from family and others if they thought instead of this person being locked up a long time, we're going to make an effort to bring them back to reality just as we would a person who has been drawn into a cult.
So help us understand what that looks like. Less law enforcement, more rehabilitation. You want us to fight this like we fight gang violence, that sort of thing?
To a certain degree. And I don't say no law enforcement. I say that they should be synergistic. They work hand in hand. Saudi Arabia and Singapore have good rehabilitation programs. England has something called the Quilliam Foundation, which goes into schools and neighborhoods and tries to educate people from a Muslim point of view. These are Muslim men and women, of how to identify and to prevent. And I think, you know, that many of us at 19, probably all of us, did very foolish things. Most of them were not, you know, were not this dangerous. But I think there's a romantic nature to this. And these young men and women, mostly men, but some women, are kind of seduced into this. And they're frequently, we know this from those who went from the Somali community in the Twin Cities to Al-Shabaab in Somalia, are bitterly disillusioned when they get there. And sometimes it costs them their lives. So, you know, there's a counter narrative. We're really not doing very well. How are we countering their propaganda? You don't fight bad theology with secularism. You fight it with good theology. And that's a piece that the Muslim community is extremely important in contributing to.
And so, Tom Mikaitis, what's the profile of one of these young Americans?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing there. There's a phenomenon we talk about called double alienation, which is something where a young person, often first generation, born in the United States or at least raised here, really doesn't identify like any immigrant, you know, first generation, with his parents by the same token. So he wants to become assimilated, but he may encounter blocks. He may encounter prejudice, discrimination. So he's in a kind of very, very dangerous dead zone where he's not grounded. Then he can, through the internet and often through personal contacts, he finds this virtual community which actually increases his isolation from the real world, but also validates, you know, hey, of course you feel this way, and that's a good thing. You're a devout Muslim. You are trying to do the will of Allah, the most compassionate and merciful, and you're living in the land of the infidels. So, of course, you should feel this way, and here's how you deal with it.
Let's get some calls in here on this. So many lined up already. Emily is in Round O, South Carolina. Emily, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Hi. Go ahead.
Well, earlier you said, you know, what do we think should be done to this boy or others like him? I think he should be treated, and it sounds awfully harsh, I guess, coming after the speaker who just spoke, but I think they need to be treated as traitors and terrorists, sent to Guantanamo, and the military trial. And the terrorism is such a horrible problem in this country. I mean, well, worldwide, but it's threatening our country. They are, you know, going to support some of our military that are actively fighting. We need to just come down really hard and really fast, enough so that the other kids will stop and think about it.
Be an example, Emily. I hear you suggesting tough justice. Let me go back to Mohammed Kaiseruddin there in Chicago. Mohammed, if someone like this young man, this 19-year-old, came to you with his concerns, his desire to head over to the Middle East, how would you counsel him? What would you say?
Well, there have been examples of our scholars and imams counseling the young people. And as a matter of fact, I think it was Adil Dawood. He had one of his friends, companions. Both of them went together to talk to the imam, and imam was able to talk to them and at least persuade one of the two people to abandon the path of violence. So the community is engaged in this thing. And let me talk to you a little bit about what Tom Mikaitis said about the rehabilitation. This is very, very important. We have talked to the FBI over here, and we've told them that, look, what you want to do is find these people and put them away, lock them away. And what we want to do is, if we find such people, we want to bring them back, rehabilitate them, mm-hmm. make sure that they are dissuaded from the violence, extremism mentality. And that's our focus. That's our importance. And the FBI is not the agency which is engaged in this thing. I do not mm-hmm. know if there is any government agency which is focusing on this thing, you know, just like alcoholism. You rehabilitate mm-hmm. from gun violence and so on and so forth. The objective should not be just to capture these people and put them away, lock them away. That way, the parents will be so scared to report if they see any young people mm-hmm. visiting any websites and so on and so forth. Why would they report to the FBI if they before taking any steps to rehabilitate them and persuade
Mohammed,
him or her?
Mohammed, thank you very much. Thomas Mikaitis, respond here, please.
Yeah, I think your caller indicates what the issue is that Americans are so afraid of terrorism, and the fear has been exaggerated, that it's so hard to catch somebody. When they do, it's like Moby Dick's, you know, the whale. They want to heap all of that anger against this threat onto the back of whoever they catch. But that kind of response, Guantanamo has probably recruited more terrorists through the anger it has produced. I'm not saying there, if the person refuses rehabilitation, then you punish. But the other piece of it is that if you rehabilitate someone, they can become an incredibly valuable source of information because in addition to bringing them back into reality, grounding them in their community, you're asking them, hey, help us to understand how you went down this path. There's a great book by a man named Mohammed Ed Hussein called The Islamist, which he documents his journey in Britain in the 80s into a radical group and how he was brought back. And it was largely through a group of, senior, Muslim men in his prayer discussion group who, really exposed him to the wisdom of the religion and so on. I understand this desire for retributive justice because we're all frightened, and when you're frightened, you get angry. But the question is, if it produces more terrorism, more radicalization, it really doesn't accomplish much. The odds are it's not going to deter people. It's actually going to make them angry, and it's going to be a source of more recruitment.
Dina Temple-Raston, jump in here. From your extensive reporting, what have you seen law enforcement doing right, and what are they doing wrong here?
Well, I did want to say that there are two government agencies that are working very hard on something they call CVE, Combating Violent Extremism. DHS has a program in which a lot of people from its program go into the community and have town hall meetings and try and discuss with parents what they should be looking for, where they should turn, whether their youth are in trouble. And the White House also has a Combating Violent Extremism initiative that I think we're going to see in the coming weeks. And it's very interesting. What they've tried to do is, instead of making it a Muslim problem, they've tried to make it a parental problem. So they have kind of put this together in a broader basket of problems that parents of high schoolers typically have. You know, there's a bullying problem, there's a internet problem. And in this basket, they've also said, and there's this combating violent there's this extremism radicalization problem. And what that's done is, by looking at it that way, it's not sort of like taking the Muslim community apart and saying, you have this problem and we're worried about just this problem. Instead, it's a basket of problems that are happening across high school populations that they're trying to remedy. In particular, they've been doing a lot of this in Minneapolis-St. Paul. I did probably two dozen stories on the Minneapolis Somalis, men who left over the course of 3 or 4 years to go and join al-Shabaab. There were 27, which is the most sort of that's the largest exodus we've seen for that sort of thing. Right, and al-Shabaab's actually an arm of al-Qaeda. Now these young men, a lot of them are trying to go inspired by these men who went before them to join Shabaab, are going to ISIS. And one of the reasons why they've been able to interdict this is because the community, now having worked with the FBI and Department of Justice and DHS, is basically saying, we're worried about this person or that person, and they are counseling them. And it's making a big difference.
Let's get another caller in here. Ruth Ann is in Dover, Delaware. Hi, Ruth Ann. Welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hello, Jane. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate your program so much. I have two questions. One, and I really appreciate what the fellow before said about rehabilitation and the double alienation problems. Mm-hmm. I really resonate with that because I think one of our solutions may be to look at this situation the same way the UN looks at a refugee camp. Whether it's a refugee camp after a war or a refugee camp after a natural disaster, they have incredibly well-documented, successful programs for rehabilitating people after disaster and dealing with their trauma triggers and what are the things that they're likely to do, for instance, join a cult or become an extremist. And it reminds me of, I did some study in South Africa, and one of the things I was taught was the Brazilian Paulo Freire, who did studies on refugee camps. And he said that we are either likely to leverage a crisis to for instance, be very creative, like necessity is the mother of invention, or we are likely to mimic the power structure of our oppressor, which means we get back at someone, the pecking order continues. So my question is anybody looking at our nation as a nation full of people that are like refugee camp people, the downward mobility of the middle class, the increased publicity of hate crimes, the radio stations that are allowed to increase fear and misinform people. And, you know, in Canada, they pulled a license of radio.
Ruth Ann, I'm going to jump in and take that last question just for time's sake. I really appreciate your call. Thank you very much. Thomas Mikaitis, would you answer?
Yeah, I think there's something really important to stress. You began the program by saying that the U.S. is nowhere near the problem of Britain and France, for that matter. I think it's really important to realize we're talking about a tiny percentage. We have not – the American Muslim community since 9/11 has been overwhelmingly loyal, patriotic citizens. No reason to presume that they're anything else. And I'm exactly right. We should not treat this as a Muslim problem. And that's because our Muslim populations are not ghettoized. There is equal opportunity on my campus. You know, we have a prayer room for Muslims as well as a chapel for Catholics and a rabbi for the Jewish population and so on. So I think I don't want to exaggerate this. I think in many ways our pluralism is an enormous strength. But there still is a lot to do. And I think what Dina said that is so powerful is when I teach this stuff around the world through the Department of Defense's Counterterrorism Fellowship Program, we talk about all hazards, all threat response. The same kind of way you deal with bullying, the way you deal with kids getting roped into drugs, gangs, etc., can become a generalized kind of model that can be adjusted for exactly this. But the safety of our young people and what they can get into is a problem for the whole country. And I don't want to exaggerate this threat. I don't want to over-focus it. And I especially don't want to ask the Muslim population to constantly apologize. No one asked me as a Christian to apologize for Anders Breivik in Norway when he went on a shooting rampage and perverted my religion in the interests of violence and evil. So I think that holistic approach that Dina talked about is, in fact, absolutely the way to go.
Mohammed Kaiser Adin, would you respond to that last very important point that Tom just made?
I truly appreciate the comments of Tom Mikaitis, and I couldn't have said it better myself. What I do want to point out is that the Muslim community is not taking this lightly. One arrest is just too many for us. So when we have these three arrests in the matter of 2 years of time, we have taken a lot of steps in order to identify the people or to counsel them before they get into any violent activities. We have youth programs where we encourage youth to speak their mind in an environment which is non-judgmental and is open, and so that whatever is bothering them, we can provide answers to them. Islamic schools in the Chicago area have added to their curriculum topics about dealing with the extremism and any pressures, tensions that they face based upon the Islamic principles of justice and Islamic principle, very fundamental principle, that no one can be held responsible for acts committed by somebody else. So Muslim community is, although the problem is small, and I appreciate Tom Mikaitis bringing that out, but we are not taking it lightly. We are trying to address this head on and even eliminate this thing. Even one or two people are just too many.
Mohammed Kaiser Adin, Chairman of the Council of Islamic Organizations of Greater Chicago, we really appreciate your time, sir, today. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're discussing Americans who join ISIS this hour, and you can join us. Are you concerned about the growing number of Americans going over to the Middle East, joining ISIS? What do you think draws them in? We're speaking this hour with Dina Temple Raston, NPR's counterterrorism correspondent, and Thomas Mikaitis, counterterrorism expert at DePaul University. I want to bring in one more voice now into the conversation, Ali Mahmoud, a senior at the University of Texas, Dallas, and founder of Alif Lam Mim, the first Muslim fraternity. Ali, so nice to have you with us.
Hi, Jane.
So you were the founder of this first Muslim fraternity in the country. What was the impetus to start this?
So it all kind of started out as a joke, is kind of what I tell a lot of people. A friend and I were joking around about the need of a fraternity for Muslims, and we're kind of wondering how that would work, knowing what the activities that a lot of fraternities are involved in and how that contradicts a lot of the values of Islam. And after we kind of thought about it, we decided to get together and ask a few brothers if they're interested, and it kind of started from there, and it's grown very quickly. It seemed that it was a need from the university, Muslim life.
So can I ask you what the conversation is around the fraternity about these situations that we're seeing unfold across the country of Americans joining ISIS, going over to the Middle East?
Right. So I think it's the sentiments that are shared in the fraternity are similar to the sentiments that are shared with a lot of young Muslims my age. And the first, we kind of have two feelings with it. On the one hand, we don't we're not too afraid, right, because we're not doing anything wrong. So we're not afraid that we're going to get accused of anything. But on the other hand, we do understand that there is a little hesitancy on our part with whatever we do post online and whatever we do say on the phone and put in our text messages, because we understand that as Muslims coming from, you know, some of our families come from countries like Syria, you know, that we have to be careful with what we post or what we like, because something can be taken the wrong way. So on the one hand, we know that we're not doing anything wrong and we're not afraid to be accused, but at the same time, we have to understand that just because of who we are, we have to be careful with what we say and how it can be taken.
I guess to dig deeper on that point, Ali, is there a conversation that is not happening more broadly among some Muslim communities in America that should be, and what is it?
I think Thomas had mentioned earlier that this isn't a huge major issue that needs to be blown up. So I would say that the Muslim community has a lot of things to deal with, and that this isn't a major one. This isn't a huge trend among young Muslims in America. But at the same time, I do think that it does need to be talked about. And on the one hand, the Muslim community as a whole can make sure that they're taking care of procedures that that ensure that people who do share harmful ideas are properly reported. But at the same time, they can do what they've been doing ever since I can remember, which is instilling a love for the country and looking towards the religion as an example of learning how to treat your community like a community. And I think, to be honest, I think that's where the root of the problem comes from. You know, people like this, they ultimately feel a lack of love, a lack of community. They feel maybe antagonized by their country or their government. They don't feel American. And so, I mean, if you look at some of the letters that were found by this young man in Chicago, a lot of them were very anti-American. And maybe just the understanding of that he is American, and that his role as a Muslim is to help Americans if he has any disagreements with them. And that's his job as a Muslim. I think that those understandings would have helped him, you know, change his course of action.
Alif, thank you. Let's get some more callers in here. Jacob in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Jacob. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane, Thomas, Muhammad, Alif, and Dina. I'm calling because I feel like there's a lot of people that have a problem with a biased understanding of what it means to be Muslim, or what Muslim activists or just people within the Muslim religion are trying to put out there. Thomas had mentioned an inflation and fear of terrorism, and I feel like that's a strong misunderstanding when it comes to Muslims and just anybody around the world as far as an activist group is concerned. When you look at it, it could be an activist group that's fueled by what they stand for, what they're trying to achieve as a group, and it could be fueled by many different things, whether it's religion, economy, resources, or if it's fueled by violence, it's going to create a lot more violence, especially if it keeps being turned down. So that's kind of what I wanted to say.
Jacob, thank you. Thomas Makaitis.
Yeah, I think your point about the ignorance of many people about Islam is extremely important. I think it's absolutely wonderful that a young man at an American university has founded a, you know, a Muslim fraternity. You know, we have not only courses on Islam at my university, but they're taught by Muslims. And I think that's a trend growing in the United States as we are increasingly a pluralistic society. There is a need for education. I think a very important place for this to occur is in American Christian churches and synagogues, where not only, you know, interfaith dialogue, a church I belong to had a very good partnership with a mosque in Morton Grove. And, you know, we would go there for Eid celebration, they would come and so on. And not only is there this, you know, exchange of information and ideas, there's breaking bread, there's fellowship. This is the sort of thing that is absolutely essential to fight this, because what you can do is the mainstream culture, whatever that means today, is to create a safe environment for your young people so they don't feel, as the gentleman in Texas said, well, that we're a little self-conscious that what we say may be taken more seriously or misunderstood than anybody else. You want to take away as much of that anxiety as possible to say, look, no, the presumption is you're a loyal American unless there is signs that you're doing something, you know, that is wrong, and that you do not deserve special scrutiny merely by being a Muslim. That is a form of racial profiling, and we have a long and terrible history of that in the United States, and we don't want to go down that route on the basis of religion as we have on the basis of race.
Dina Temple Raston, weigh in here.
Well, I think that there is a problem with there being too much focus on, you know, the radical Muslims instead of the community as a whole. I agree with that. I also think that I've seen over the course of 10 years of covering this a real interest in the Muslim community of fixing this problem. And I don't think that gets enough airtime, I would say. I also think that what we're seeing is very high-ranking people within the Muslim community, scholars, coming out in a way that they never have before. Sheikh Abdullah bin Baya, who is a very high-ranking Muslim scholar, considered one of the 30 most influential Muslims in the world, came out with a fatwa against ISIS. And he was actually mentioned in President Obama's speech at the UN as being an example of the sort of thing that they're hoping to do, like this fraternity at the university, where the Muslim community is weighing in a much more high-profile way to show that they are against this. And these sort of snap judgments that people have about the community and whether they care about this can be alleviated a little bit.
Speaking of that, let me play some sound here. This is from the Not In My Name campaign. The Active Change Foundation, which is a community organization in East London, built a Twitter campaign in September with the hashtag Not In My Name. The campaign denounces the Islamic State, distances Islam from the terrorist organization. And the organization created a YouTube video, promoted the campaign, received more than 200,000 hits.
The ISIS do not represent Islam or any Muslim.
Because it's totally un-Islamic.
Because they're killing innocent people.
Because you're unjust.
We must all unite together and try to stop this group from damaging Islam and damaging Muslims.
Not in my name.
Ali Mahmoud, the founder of the first national Muslim fraternity in this country. Are you familiar with this campaign? Do you see it as effective?
Yeah, I've seen it online, and I've heard a couple of opinions on it. On the one hand, people are saying, you know, as Muslims, we don't need to apologize. We're done apologizing. This group has nothing to do with our religion. In fact, by apologizing, we're reinforcing the fact that they have anything to do with us and that their motives aren't political but rather religious. So some people, they appreciate it but don't agree with it. On the other hand, some others say, you know, whether ISIS has anything to do with Islam, people think it does. And it is our role and our responsibility as Muslims to make sure that things are clarified. So I think there's been a couple of opinions on that, and I understand the truth behind both of them. So I think the Muslim community is kind of caught between two opinions on that. Neither of them obviously justifying anything from ISIS, but some people disagreeing on whether disagreeing or apologizing for ISIS is the right thing to do.
Let's get another call in here from Montreal, Canada. Khalil is on the line. Khalil, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
They told me to make my point brief, so I'm going to try to do it as quickly as I can. I'm a Muslim, second generation. I grew up in Canada. And as a son of an immigrant, I feel like myself and all the Muslims I know, we really love the countries that we've grown up in, America and Canada, and these countries have done so much for us and for our parents. And a pious Muslim knows that by the religious law, you have to obey the laws of the country that you live in. So just by using Islam in itself, we can clarify to these young men who are angry and alienated that the proper application of their Islamic sentiment is to be the best American and Canadian citizens that they possibly can be. And obviously they're angry because of the killing of civilians in the Middle East by the Assad regime, primarily in Syria, which is the main reason all these guys want to go out and fight. So maybe it's time that instead of locking all these guys up or treating them as terrorists, we do what your other speakers have been talking about. We rehabilitate them and maybe even start some kind of, you know, legion or something under the auspices of the CIA, because we have no moderate forces out there to represent America to fight the good fight. All we have is ISIS or nothing. So maybe these men need to be redirected.
Khalil, thank you very much. Let me get another caller in here. Charmaine is in Plainfield, Connecticut. Charmaine, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hello, Jane.
Hi.
How are you?
Fine. Go ahead.
Now, I do support anything that would help rehabilitate a young man who has lost his way, because young people do lose their way no matter his background. However, for some, how about just giving them the option of citizenship and fighting for whoever they like? I mean, it is still an option of any person to choose to fight for whomever they choose. And it is their option. Just give up their citizenship and go off and fight. I mean, why should we prosecute someone just because we don't agree with who they want to fight for?
Charmaine, thank you. Thank you very much for the call. Let's get another thought in here from Dennis in Princeton, Wisconsin. Hi, Dennis. You're on. Welcome.
Hi. Well, my comment would be this, is that while many people want to say it's not a Muslim problem, when you listen to the Muslim callers call in, they'll say, well, it's not being a true Muslim, and they're claiming ownership over the Muslim problem. I think the Muslim community needs to recognize that it is a Muslim problem, and that it's Muslims talking to Muslims who are radicalizing these folks, and that the Muslim community needs to reject the idea of, say, Sharia law as being a part of a state's legal system, that it's a religious law, and the separation of church and state that we as Americans hold dear shouldn't be. You know, you would have to reject that within your religion, in my opinion, to be able to be to recognize our constitutional separation of church and state.
Dennis, thank you. Ali Mahmoud, just for time's sake, let me have you respond to Dennis's question and call here.
Right. So I just wanted to address the issue he mentioned about religion being, I misinterpreted what he said, but it seemed like he was saying religion was the issue, and that Muslims are the issue. But when you look at what a lot of these people are saying who are joining ISIS and all these other terrorist organizations, a lot of times they cite political reasons as opposed to religious reasons. A lot of times if you look at their lifestyles, a lot of them contradict the lifestyles of someone who considers who's considered a practicing Muslim. So while some of these people may be part of the community by name, they rather see Islam as an issue of identity rather than an issue of where they gain their values and their ethics. So I think that's, mm-hmm. that's the main thing to address with regards to what he mentioned.
Tom Mikaitis, you want to jump in, I hear.
Yeah, I do. I think the caller is I understand the point of view, but Sharia is a very complex thing and it varies from place to place. I mean, I assume that the fraternity in Texas does not have binge drinking as one of its activities. That's an example of applying a principle from your law in the same way that keeping kosher if you're Jewish or keeping similar dietary laws if you're Muslim is part of it. You can, in your private life and even in your public life, be guided by religious principles. I try to do that, and still obey the laws of the state. So that's a false choice to say that. And, you know, quite honestly, as a Christian, I feel obligated to speak out. I mean, if individuals want to say it's okay to blow up abortion clinics and murder doctors, if there's a very strong Christian identity movement in parts of the United States that said, you know, we should be a white nation, we should be a Christian nation, they've engaged in violence or the threat of violence, I feel that I do have an obligation to say something about that. Because, as I said, you need to counter their bad theology with good theology, and people within the faith are the ones best able to do that. On the other hand, you do not want to put any religious community on the spot for having to apologize as though they themselves or their group or their mosque or their religion as a whole is somehow responsible. That is what is wrong.
Dina Temple-Raston, in our last minute here, wrap us up. What should Americans understand broadly about the issues we've discussed this hour?
Well, I think it's important to make a distinction between people who are going to Syria versus people who are actually going to join ISIS versus people who are joining al-Qaeda. And I think these things have gotten mixed up. I also think this people think that hundreds of Americans have gone to this. And this really is a very, very tiny sliver of people. I mean, a dozen people have gone to join ISIS. It's not very many people. And it's going to be a problem, but they're trying to get on top of it.
Dina Temple-Raston, counterterrorism correspondent for National Public Radio. Dina, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thomas Mikaitis, counterterrorism expert from DePaul University. Thank you very much, Thomas.
You're welcome.
And Ali Mahmoud, founder of the first national Muslim fraternity in the country, senior at the University of Texas, Dallas. Really appreciate your time, Ali. Good luck to you and thanks.
My pleasure.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, the new blue-collar jobs. We'll look at where they are and what it will take to get one. Tom's back tomorrow. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.